Hey there, Boardroom podcast listeners. Let me tell you about the Boardroom Surfboard Show presented by U.S. Blanks coming up here September 25th and 26th at the Del Mar Fairgrounds. We've got a packed house, unbelievable exhibitors, the entire surfboard manufacturing industry under one roof. As we honor Pat Rawson in the Icons of Foam shaping competition, Pat has invited Ricky Carroll, Bill Barnfield, Valerie Duprat, Chris Christensen, Timmy Patterson, and a few others, including our defending champion, Ryan Birch. In addition, there will be a live stream of the event on Surfline and RevChem Composites with Douglas Surf Company are presenting an exhibit called How It's Made. Zio Baffa Organic Italian Wines is presenting the Best in Show competition. And Board Shaper, along with Keyed In, is presenting the Boardroom Talks, hosted by Chris Morrow. And a bunch of other stuff on tap, unfolding as we speak. Exciting times. 2 months away, September 25th and 26th, the Boardroom Surfboard Show, presented by U.S. Blanks. By the way, I got to tell you about the exclusive dinner. 8 people get to sit down with Mr. Pat Rawson, our icon of foam, and enjoy a 3-course meal at one of my favorite restaurants in San Diego, Ranch 45. Ranch 45's mission is to be an extension of the farms that they use through the food and drink that they serve. Ranch 45 on Via de la Valle, right across the street from the Del Mar Racetrack and next to Pamplemousse. You can catch me there quite often in the morning for my after surf breakfast croissant and coffee. I like to hang out on their patio, feel the fresh ocean breeze, and frankly, it's a place where I do a lot of business. Ranch 45 for a 3-course meal with you, Pat Rawson, and 7 other lucky individuals. That's Friday night, September 24th, Friday night before the Boardroom Show. Tickets for the show, tickets for the dinner, all the tickets will be on sale shortly, and you can go to boardroomshow.com to access the ticketing platform. Also on tap, September 18th through October 2nd, we'll have bidding on the California Gold Surf Auction, Barns, Rafters, and Honey Holes, a curated selection of pure surf gold. Bidding opens September 18th, bidding closes October 2nd, and we've got some absolutely mind-blowing, jaw-dropping vintage surfboards. You're going to want to check that out. And let me tell you about Headstock Guitar Lovers Festival happening in San Diego, November 6th and 7th. If you love guitars, if you geek out on guitars the way that I do, you might want to check out the Headstock Guitar Lovers Festival. Again, November 6th and 7th in San Diego. For more information, visit guitarloversfestival.com. And now, onto the podcast. Sean Thompson, 1977 IPS World Champion. In 1977, I was 12 years old. And like most 12-year-old surf groms, I was a kid who devoured surf magazines and every surf movie and, frankly, anything that had to do with surfing at all. And back then, it was basically magazines and movies. And guess what? The big three for me were Mark Richards, Rabbit Bartholomew, and Sean Thompson. These guys were and still are my surf heroes. I've since been lucky enough to interview all three of these gentlemen, and the one striking similarity that runs through all three of these champions is passion and competitive fire, and I think you'll sense some of that from Sean here in a moment. On this episode of the Boardroom Podcast, Sean Thompson. Let us begin. Okay, Sean Thompson, welcome to the Boardroom Podcast. Sean, you can hear me okay, buddy?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly. Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
I am doing great. And Sean, the 1977 world champion. Sean, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I'm surprised you've never been on the show before.
Yeah, you know, I live up here in sleepy Santa Barbara. It's kind of a forgotten sector up here.
I don't know about that, but what kind of music do you listen to, Sean?
Like Traffic, my favorite. Stevie Winwood, Jim Capaldi, that old school stuff, you know. But I mean, I love some modern music. I'm really into a guy called Slade Cleaves, who's a it's not country, but it's more like Americana blues. Mm-hmm. Kind of got a sort of a almost like a country blues vibe. But to me, I think he's one of the greatest modern poets up there with Bob Dylan.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. A guy called Slade, S-L-A-I-D, Cleaves, C-L-E-A-V-E-S.
Is that your wife in the background?
Like, no, they don't have to worry about a podcast. It's like anything. It's like,
oh, it's all good.
They just laugh, you know what I mean? Like, I don't laugh and son, they just, you know, I can be on to like thousands of people. My son will just roll through. And
yeah, my son might roll through in a minute too. So you're not alone there.
He's sitting in the doorway.
Yeah.
What did she say?
She said, I'm sitting in the doorway. Yeah. Classic.
Yeah. Hey, what about podcasts? Do you listen to podcasts?
No, I don't. I actually don't listen to podcasts. Every now and then I'll be driving and I'll like jump onto something. But I've listened to a few of Guy Kawasaki, a mate of mine.
Yeah.
Get some really interesting guests. I don't. I'm actually being quite busy. We sold our house, bought a new house. We've been renovating it and then got a lot of like projects involved with like live streams. So I haven't really, it seems like a, and then I got to try to find some time to catch some waves. Time is at a premium these days.
It really is. It's kind of a blessing. You know, I've been sitting on my hands for a year and a half and all of a sudden I'm swamped. You give a lot of talks, John. Your talks are motivational. I know they're good. I've heard them before. They're very sincere. And I've heard you motivate surfers during the 100 Wave Challenge. So what I'd like to know is, can you tell me about a situation where maybe a talk didn't go so well for you?
Yeah, you know, I've been pretty lucky there with getting a good response from people. People are I think, very respectful. And I haven't done an in-person talk. The last in-person talk I did was in late February last year. I actually flew out to Chicago to do a series of three talks, one for a large medical staffing company, another for a Surfrider Foundation. It was a pro bono talk. Whenever I do a paid talk, I always try to do at least one or two talks for the community. And those were both canceled. And then my last talk was for a school. So I had one with a school. We did that. And the next two were canceled as COVID was starting to hit. So people I found are generally usually very, very respectful. They appreciate the time that you're giving. And they've come there to get something from you. You know, I found it's interesting that there is this culture in the world. People want to learn. Over COVID, I've spoken to about 150,000 people. 150,000 people. I mean, huge events. And I found that people have been really beaten down. I call it a sad state of mind, stress, anxiety, despair. Because I ask people to send me one word that describes how they're feeling. So I use this really cool technology in my talks, and these words come across the web and they form a word cloud. And over the last sort of year, 18 months, it's really been stress, anxiety, despair. Those have been disconnection. Those have been the three big words. Yes, there are some words about hope and optimism. And then I end my talk, everyone writes their code. It's called, it's a really process of personal reflection and personal empowerment to commit to a positive path. So I'll get people to write 12 lines. It takes 15 minutes. And then after that, I ask people, send me one line that describes how you're feeling in the context of COVID and a line that is about being better. And people will send, I'll pray, I'll have faith, I'll be a better friend, I'll be a better dad. Beautiful words. Everyone writes really beautiful words. And I've come to realize that, number one, people want to be better. It's a fundamental life mission. Our life purpose can be described in two lines. One is about, I want to be better. So people will send these amazing lines about being better. And then the other line, which is so cool, people want to help others be better. So we are all genetically predisposed to helping others be better. So that's our life purpose. We want to be better. We want to help others be better. But it's so strange that in the context of surfing, so I've never done a talk for a surfing company ever in my life. I've worked with the biggest companies in the whole world for hundreds of thousands of people. And I've actually gone to surfing companies and said, you know, I would love to help you with your teams. I will do it free. No one ever calls me back, not even free.
Why?
Because I'll tell you why. Too lazy to learn and too cool for school. People wonder why I'm talking the peripheral companies in the surf industry. I'm not talking about the wetsuit guys. I'm not talking about the surfboard guys. You're all doing really well right now.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about the guys who've made billions out of this industry and are now trying to like scratching their heads and figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, where am I going wrong? I'll tell you where you're going wrong. Too cool for school and too lazy to learn.
Yeah.
Which is completely contrary to I'm not saying mainstream, but I'm saying that culture.
To our innate humanness, which you just described, that's what we want to do. We want to get better. We want to help other people get better.
Yeah.
And learning is a part of that. And it blows your mind that people don't want to learn.
No, it's I'm saying it's not people. It's these people that run these companies, because private equity has taken, and these people who are disconnected to the soul and spirit of what we all love, they've taken over this business and convoluted it so that it's not connected to the spirit.
You're speaking specifically of soft goods companies, and we're not going to pinpoint which ones, but am I correct when we're talking about? So let me ask you this. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Somebody comes to you, private equity company comes to Instinct in whatever, 1983 or whatever, and says, hey, we want to buy your entire company for X times 10. You're going to sell it. That's why you created the company, to sell it, right?
Yeah.
And now you're disconnected. Now the salt's out of the business. Sean's gone. Some guy in New York or Madison Avenue is running the company. And it's just not really a surf company anymore, correct?
It's interesting. I don't think it has to be owned by a surfer to still be connected to the surf vibe and to the surf culture and still have a soul.
Yeah.
And this certainly comes from the leadership. You know, I went back to university and for a couple of years, and I studied the science of leadership. I mean, I did my post-grad. I mean, when I was on the tour, I was at university. When I completed the tour, I completed my university, my economics and management undergrad degree. And then I went back, and leadership can still connect you to the beach and to the soul of serving. Like, I've met these amazing leaders, and they're not surfers. They love the surfing metaphor because they've had me come in. You know what I mean? I'm talking about high tech companies or industrial companies or General Motors or, you know, these like mega Cisco mega companies, because surfing has this wonderful way of connecting people to what's important in life.
Yeah.
Surfing has these sort of this fundamental power, and the ocean has this fundamental power. But it's like many of the people that are running these surf companies don't realize it. And they are the ones that are closest to it. These are the people that should be so, so thankful and appreciative of what surfing is. And it's not, surfing's not just there to generate profit and, you know, profit, sales, and growth. Surfing's there to give people spiritual lessons and make their lives better and make the teams and the employees' lives better. But I cannot understand why they are not aware of it. It blows me. I tell you what, Scott, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
blows my mind.
Well, let me bring it back a little bit. I'm going to bring you to a place that I know you've talked a lot about. You probably get a little bit sick of talking about it, but I want to tell you first that when I was 13 years old, it was 1978. And I've told you this before. I devoured everything Sean Thompson. You were my idol. You and Rabbit and Mark Richards, those three guys were like my guys, you know, and you guys were plastered all over my walls, as was the case with many 13-year-olds in 1978.
Thank you.
And your movie Busting Down the Door was phenomenal. I mean, talk about being in my personal wheelhouse, this whole thing just unfolding in front of me. And, you know, your crew at that time, the Busting Down the Door crew, so to speak, was, you know, you were these upstarts and you were sort of going up against old school guys. And of course, you were going up against elements that didn't really appreciate you guys being in the limelight. And famously, Eddie Rothman was one of these guys and he was against you and it was quite personal. And he was an enemy. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but was it difficult for you to ask Eddie, say 25 years later, to appear in your documentary? Like, what was that strategy like in your mind when you're like, Eddie Rothman is a crucial part of this story. I need to get him on film, but I don't necessarily like this person. Like, was that difficult for you to approach him and go, hey, haven't heard from you in a while, but so can you tell me a little bit about approaching Eddie Rothman to be in that movie?
You know, it's a classic because, I mean, Eddie and I, you know, we had ups and downs, but I always liked the bloke in some sort of way. You know, he had this... He's a very charismatic dude, you know. That's why he was so powerful on the North Shore. He's just he had this cunningness, this like intelligence, and also this like an unreal sense of humor. The guy was he's a very sort of, I mean, I like the dude, even though, you know, I got a couple of slaps from him and I got told I was going to get killed and all that stuff. And, you know, his gangsters, you know, I got a couple good shots from some of his compadres. And I had one winter there that was, you know, particularly terrifying. I went out and bought a 12-gauge shotgun and loaded it up. But I always had this... I sort of liked the dude. I don't know why, but I did. But he, and you know, in the movie, the great irony was I asked him because I wanted his take, because Busting Down the Door wasn't going to be like a one-sided viewpoint of these white colonialists that came in and conquered surfing. That was because it was never that way. And certainly I didn't want it to be portrayed that way. I mean, in fact, Busting Down the Door, I think, was the first doco ever that portrayed the illegal annexation of Hawaii by the United States. I mean, we put it out there front and center. So I knew I had to get Eddie's a take on it, as I had to, you know, get a lot of people's take on it, because I wanted a fair reflection of that period, which was really, you know, a group of bloody guys who wanted to change their world that maybe could have been significantly more knowledgeable about Hawaiian culture and what had actually happened over that, you know, colonialist period. But I asked Eddie, because my whole crew, you know, everyone was terrified and no one wanted to interview Eddie. I said, well, I'll interview Eddie, you know what I mean? We went round to his house and he was very, you know, very kind to do that. And certainly without him, the movie certainly wouldn't have been what it was. But I asked him, I said, so Eddie, what do you do right now? Now, I showed the movie at the Maui Film Festival in front of, I don't know, there must have been a couple of thousand people there in this big auditorium. And when I ask Eddie what he does, and he spins his hands and he said, I'm involved in real estate transactions. The whole place erupted and everyone laughed, not because they were laughing at Eddie Rothman, but they knew, like, they knew what he really did and what he was saying he did, when in fact, he's done like 32 real estate developments. Yeah. The guy's like a real estate genius. Yeah. And if you look at the North Shore now, and this is what people don't know. And you look at the North Shore now, and why isn't that place, why hasn't that place been raped by overdevelopment and crass development and hotels and crap everywhere? I'll tell you why, because of Eddie Rothman. Because that dude has like stopped that shit. So there's a duality there with yeah. Eddie Rothman. Yes, he's been a gangster and terrorized people, but also, you know, he's responsible, I think, in many ways for like keeping the country country, which is yeah. something that I don't think anyone else could have pulled off. Yeah, he's got total duality there.
it's a super interesting take, right? Because I think about like Saddam Hussein. Like everyone's like, oh my God, Saddam Hussein, he's horrible. Get rid of him. As soon as we got rid of him, we got ISIS. Like this power vacuum was created and this horrible thing took over. And the thing with Eddie is that he's held his ground. And as we look back on it 30 years later, we're like, hey, it's probably a good thing that he's around.
Yeah, I think in a way he's brought a tough man sensibility to that aspect of the North Shore, you know, for the good and for the bad as well. So I mean, I was really stoked when he agreed to be interviewed, and I think we portrayed him fairly. We portrayed him as a tough guy, which is what he is, and I think a lot of people really appreciated that drama that he brought to the film, and he really I think he portrayed it up, which was great.
And it's my understanding that he also came out here to the West Coast and sat as like one of the stars of the movie, sort of in a.
Actually, he came to the premiere, and I was stoked. He came there, and he had all his knuckle dusters on, you know, like he looked gnarly and he looked tough, and he is. He's gnarly and he's tough, and that's the way he is, absolutely unapologetic. And maybe he wants to bark about the movie, but let me tell you, the movie I think portrayed him in a great light, as a tough guy. And you know, in his day, Eddie was a good surfer too. I remember that dude going for it. I remember the one Pipeline Masters in the 80s. Man, I saw that guy paddle over the falls into the pit on a wave at Pop. I thought he was dead. Yeah. And he's spoken about it too, about that wave. And I'm going, man, that guy got some cojones. Paddle over the edge. I thought the guy was going to die. But he went for it, you know, which is cool.
You know, speaking of that era and speaking of underrated surfers, from the Bustin' Down the Door era, who are some guys that maybe didn't get their due or, you know, aren't in the, you know, like when we think of Bustin' Down the Door era, we think obviously of you and of Rabbit and of MR and of PT and, you know, maybe even Mark Warren is thrown into that mix. Of course, Ian Cairns is in that mix. Who are some guys that maybe are underrated from that time?
Well, you know, I really wanted to show in the movie along with, you know, with our crew, like who were the gods in Hawaii to me, like, you know, the Mount Rushmore type guys. There was three guys. Well, not three. There was, I suppose there was four, but the three guys to me were the two guys from the Power Brigade, and that was Jeff Heckman and BK, like raw carving power. Then Rina Abalero, which combined the power with the style and the art, and then certainly Jerry. You know, Jerry was more just like a pop that had that sort of finesse and the delicacy. But those were the sort of four guys. And, you know, I really wanted to recognize them as well, because those were the heroes and those were the guys that we looked up to. And then also Eddie Aikau, you know, Eddie had his beautiful classic Hawaiian style. And, you know, 77, he won his only contest. He won the Duke the year that I won my world title and that Rabbit and I were gunning for the world title. And then 78, you know, we lost Eddie. But I suppose from a surfing perspective, And, you know, it's like you just couldn't include everyone, although we did have some waves of them was Larry Bertelman, who was just like amazing. I mean, what an amazing surfer. And then just underneath him, you had Larry, you had Mark Liddell and Buttons. You know, they were both fabulous surfers. But Larry really had a range. I mean, he could ride anywhere. He could ride Pop, he could ride Sunset, he could ride like 3 foot off the wall. So he was really an unbelievable surfer. So I would say if there was one guy who maybe like, how can you say Larry Bertelman's underrated? But
well, exactly. You bring up a great point, because the guys you mentioned aren't necessarily underrated. Yeah. I was going to throw a name at you, and I don't think this guy's underrated, but he's blowing my mind that he's 60 something years old and he's pulling into 8 foot backdoor.
Oh, Michael Ho. Are you talking about Michael Ho? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. But Michael, I think we mentioned the movie, but he was sort of like, he was
younger maybe.
Yeah, he was a bit younger, but what an amazing surfer. And also a guy, he could ride anything. You know, Michael Ho could ride 2 foot and he could ride 32 foot. And you know, he would charge equally. He was sort of this, he had such an unusual type of surfing too. You know, he'd ride these, he was the first guy to really ride tiny boards and big stuff at Sunset. You know, he must probably be riding 12 inches shorter than all of us guys. I mean, he's quite a small bloke.
Yeah.
But he was, and also what an amazing surfer, great tube rider, backside, front side. You know, when he won that Pop Masters, I think 82 or 83, that broken arm, it was certainly, certainly a benchmark day.
And it just blows my mind that he's 60 something years old. I want to say he's 62. I don't really know, but he's at backdoor pipe this winter, coming out of the tube with his arms behind his back, soul arching as he doggy doors the thing. Yeah. That's just mind blowing.
No, it was great to see. I really got Michael has got some great genes there. Yeah.
So another thing that you and I've spoken about that I'd like to hear about again is there's this incredibly classic moment. I think it's from Free Ride, but it might be from many classic moments. It's from one of the movies. And of course it was covered religiously in the magazines back in the day. And that's this wave that you shared with Mark Richards, which is extremely symbolic at Off the Wall, where Mark Richards cuts you off in the tube. And you guys pull into the tube together and ride through this barrel together and both kick out together, or maybe you straightened out and he kicks out. Tell me about that wave. What led up to that wave? What was it like to be cut off by Mark Richards? And what do you guys say about this wave to this day? Because by the way, I've heard a different version from MR.
yeah. That was a pretty classic wave. And, you know, it sort of really represents, I think, the high point of the single fin, end of 77, and then also it represents the newness of the twin. And, it represents both the ending and a beginning, that one wave, which is super rare in surfing, where you have like one wave that represents a pivotal moment. And it wasn't a wave in competition either. It was just one wave that represents an end and a beginning. So MR and I, we never used to drop in on each other. In fact, none of us guys, it was very, very seldom that we would drop in on each other. You know, there was unbelievable respect. Same with the Hawaiian guys. You know, no one really used to drop in on anyone else. I mean, Pipeline was different with, you know, Jerry and Rory, and their crew was a different vibe there. Everyone would be dropping in on everyone else out there because it's just that's just the way it was. It was much more free flowing, but there was way more respect with us guys. So this was like an epic day. It was like the day of the year at Off the Wall, you know, 6 to 8 and perfect, all the cameras on the beach. So like, there was a lot of like performance anxiety. Everyone wanted to be the best they could be in front of everyone else. So we'd all been surfing for a few hours, and MR had just like brought his twin fin out there. It was like maybe the second day he'd launched it. So, you know, no one really knew what it was all about. You know, he was surfing really well, and you had this bright yellow wetsuit and the bright board. So I took off on a wave and MR dropped in on me. And it was debatable as to whether I would make it or not. And I thought he'd seen me, but you know, after talking to him and people years later, it's like he hadn't seen me, but he dropped in. And I was like furious, like, how could MR drop in on me? So I went out, and on the very next wave, I dropped in on him. And now all MR is seeing is that I've dropped in on him. So that next wave now he's pissed off because I've dropped in on him, and he hasn't realized that he had dropped in on me. Legitimately he hadn't seen me. So I'm paddling into it, and it's a nice set wave. And as I'm paddling, and I see MR paddling out towards me in a bloody absolute fury, and he swings around and he takes off. And as he takes off, you know, he pushes me towards the inside. So I know he's going to deliberately try to stuff me here, which is super rare because, you know, MR and I never, ever had the head to head because we just respected each other so much. So I remember dropping in, and we're both, it was a pretty late drop. And like now I've got MR in front of me, and I hated to ride waves with other people. You know, I no matter what anyone says, and maybe, you know, you'll have these bullshit commentators out there, I've very, very seldom dropped in on people, man. I came from the Bay of Plenty, and you just didn't drop in ever. You waited your turn. And if you didn't wait your turn, you got a good, strong smack. That's the way it was. We had a code there. So if someone, I was sitting waiting for a wave, a person paddled around me out of turn, I would drop in on him 100% of the time. If a person tried to take off out of turn, I would drop in 100% of the time. But that's it. I hated to ride waves with people unless someone just deliberately dropped, you know, paddle around my inside. So anyway, we're dropping in real late. And like, I'm really behind the eight ball because like I'm going, you know, I'm being faded. And as MR cranks his turn, I crank my turn up on the single fin. Now a single fin, it could hold a tighter line on the face than a single. Okay. It wasn't as fast from A to B. It wasn't as fast through the tube or on the face, but it could hold a tighter line because of the single fin. And remember, I was riding like an 11-inch tail with an 8 1/4-inch skeg. It wasn't even a fin. It was a skeg that was 3 inches back from the pintail. Man, 11-inch tail, that's a teeny tiny tail. And MR was most probably on a 15-inch tail, you know, with his twin. So I managed to pull the turn up tighter on the face than Mark. And then the whole wave throws out ahead of us. So I could just see him ahead of me. And like you do not want to be riding inside the tube behind someone else, especially someone with like two fins. But like MR is most probably the most solid surfer in the world. And the amount of, you just don't see MR wipe out. He would hardly ever wipe out. I mean, I asked him a couple of years ago, hey, MR, you made all those days we rode Waimea. No, I never ever wiped out once. He never wiped out once in his whole life at Waimea Bay. I saw him compete in 4 events on the Australian tour in 79 when he was demolishing. I never saw him fall off once in 3 months. Yeah. In 3 months. So, like, I had a good chance of, like, not dying. So I pulled up behind him, and we rode through the tube together. And MR thought he had dusted me on the turn. And as he comes out, and I come out, I go, woo, and I see MR look back at me, and I knew, ah. Yes, it was a really, really fun wave. And it's the only thing I don't joke about with MR, because I think it's still a bit of a sore point. But he, you know, he went on to like win 4 world titles. So I suppose that's some consolation.
Yeah. No, his version of it is he doesn't remember the first wave. He remembers the second and third wave.
Because we don't, you know, we just wouldn't drop in. Well, they rabbit dropped in on us a little bit, but not much.
Well, tell me a little bit about the Shapers during that era. I know you've spoken to me about your love of Tom Parrish's surfboards and of course, Spider Murphy. And I believe Bill Barnfield made you some boards. What were some of your experiences with Tom Parrish?
Yeah, you know, I loved to work with a lot of shapers. Through my career, I remember I counted up, I've worked with 34 different shapers. And many of those 34 became really, really famous. I mean, I was just stoked to be involved with their evolution, you know, like Rusty in his early days, Al Merrick in his early days. I was the first pro surfer that Al Merrick ever shaped for, one of the first few that Rusty ever shaped for. I loved working with Tom Parrish. You know, the first Hawaiian shaper I ever got boards from was Ben Apa in 1970. I mean, I got two amazing boards from Ben. The first twin fin I ever got was from Ben Apa in
what was that like, Sean? Where did you fly to Hawaii and just go,
yeah,
I need to find Ben Apa, or who should I fly? Like, yeah, did you even have a clue?
I'd been there in 1969 for my bar mitzvah present, the first time I ever went to Hawaii, and we stopped off. We instead of traveling west, we traveled east. We landed in Australia, spent a week in Sydney, and I got boards from Midget Farrelly, because Midget had come to South Africa the year before for the first Gunston 500, which became a very big surfing event. And my dad had flown him out, because my dad bought this surfboard company in South Africa called Wetland that was going bankrupt. My dad bought it. And as a promotion, him and Max Wetland and another partner decided to put on the world's first professional surfing event. And they flew Midget out to give an exhibition. So I met Midget. And then I loved Midget, was my hero. And then we flew to Sydney, got boards from Midget for my first trip to Hawaii. So I was always very involved with getting boards from great shapers. 70, I got boards from wonderful boards from Ben Apa. And then I got boards from Randy Rarick. And then when I first started having success in Hawaii, I was riding Spider Murphys, who I first got boards from when I think I was 16 years old. And my first win was on a Barry Kanaipuni 8-4 at 12 to 15 foot sunset. So, you know, Barry was just this amazing shape. And then the following year, I started getting boards from Tom Parrish, who had been making boards for Jeff Hackman. Jeff had previously been getting boards from Dick Brewer, and then found Tom Parrish. And then all of us Aussies and South Africans started getting boards from Tom Parrish. You know, they called him the man with a red hot planer. And it was just wonderful to work with him. He had a little shaping bay, and I'd, you know, stand in the shaping bay for a couple of hours while he hand-shaped these big clock blanks. And then I started getting boards from Bill Barnfield, amazing boards from Bill Barnfield, Glenn Minami. And it was just a, you know, wonderful experience to not just, you know, phone up a shaper and say, listen, I want a 5'10" that's maybe a little bit thinner than my last 5'10". You know, over the last couple of days, I've spoken to a couple of shapers about, you know, to get some background for my Olympic broadcast. And I spoke to Timmy Patterson, who shapes Italo Ferreira's boards. I spoke at length, and I spoke to Matt Biolis at length about his shaping philosophy and how he deals with his riders. And Matt's got a number of great riders in the Olympics. Got Chloe Andino, Carissa Moore, Carolyn Marks. And it's really interesting to speak to these artists, because that's what I think shapers are. I think they're artists. Plus, I think they're also psychologists and psychiatrists as well.
these days, now more than ever, probably.
about their shaping philosophy and their theories and, you know, the low entry and, you know, their theories on concaves and single to double concaves, their theories on rails. And it's been really wonderful to see how these modern guys relate to their shapers. And, you know, talking about, like, well, where's going to be the next breakthrough? You know, where's that going to come from?
Let me ask you this. I'm of the opinion that when you look at world champions, especially recently, you think of Kelly. Obviously, Kelly was on Al's boards forever. You think of Tom Curran. Tom Curran was on Al's boards forever. You think of Gabe. Gabe's been riding basically Johnny Cabianca's boards for a long time. Elo's been riding Timmy's boards for 4 or 5, maybe longer, right? And then you look at guys that probably should have world titles. It could be argued if things went their way. And these guys didn't necessarily stay with one shaper for a long time. Guys like Taj Burrow jumped around a lot, was riding Maurice's boards, Firewires, all sorts of stuff. The other big example is Jordy. Jordy's jumped around a lot. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm saying if you look at the track record of the other champions, and you can look at women too, Lisa Anderson, Al Marix. Do you think there's a connection here between guys that stick with the shapers? They have a better chance of knowing their equipment and thereby feeling comfortable. One less thing to deal with.
Absolutely. I'm in total agreement. You know, there's a millimeter. There's a 32nd of an inch difference between winning and losing. Okay. Being a champion and being in second place. And you don't really know where it's going to come from. But if you have an absolutely confident and committed mindset, it can help you cross over that massive millimeter divide. And let me tell you, that millimeter divide, it's a millimeter that's wider than the Grand Canyon. Let me tell you, that 1 millimeter is wider than the Grand Canyon. And I really believe that having confidence in your equipment, absolute confidence and knowledge in your equipment, can help you cross that Grand Canyon of a millimeter.
What was that millimeter for you in 1977?
So I had Spider Murphy equipment, and I knew that when I pedaled out of my 7.0 in the last event of the year, the World Cup, when Rabbit and I had to win or get into the finals to win the world title, I knew that with that Spider Murphy, I was invincible.
Was that the blue one, the blue deck?
Blue one, yeah, the blue 7.0.
Yeah.
So I think that
is that the Grand Canyon for you? Are you saying that it was the
I'm saying that I had that absolute confidence.
Right, okay.
Absolute confidence in my equipment. And then in 1978, when I changed shapers.
Yeah.
When my dad started his own shop in South Africa, and I moved away from Spider, man, it dissolved for me. And I lost that power and that confidence. And it took me a while to get it back again on different, riding different equipment. And but I never won another world title. Man, I came second and came really close riding a Spider.
Was it 83 or 84? That was 85. Okay, 85.
That was 85, but I was, I was on a Spider and came really close again, and came close a few other times. But that confidence that a great board can give you and a great shaper can give you, that's why I say these shapers are like psychologists and psychiatrists, and also like father figures. Certainly, Al Merrick was a father figure to Tom Curran. Al Merrick was a father figure to Kelly Slater. And once Kelly stopped riding L's, he never won another world title. So the shaper relationship is of vital importance to a surfer's competitive success and confidence mindset.
You've seen every iteration, Sean, of professional surfing, and you've seen it up close. And I mean pre-IPS to Fred's IPS to Ian's ASP, to another iteration of the ASP, to then Rabbit's ASP Dream Tour, to three or four, or at least three iterations of the WSL, starting with the NFL guy, and then to Sophie, and now with Eric Logan. You've seen different stakeholders, and you've seen their approaches. In your opinion, what are the organizational highlights from each of these eras? Where have they got it right?
So Rabbit Bartholomew, my great friend and rival, I think stated it really succinctly: the best surface and the best waves. And to me, if the WSL follows that mission, they will not go wrong. Best surface and the best waves. Really, really, really simple. And when Ian took over, and Ian also a great friend, great rival, we disagree on lots and lots of different things.
Yeah.
But Ian had a philosophy of contest a week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I remember my last couple of years on tour surfing in like 28 events.
Yeah.
28 events in waves. Like back then, Simon had dropped off the tour. Mark Richards dropped off the tour. I think I was like one of the tallest guys on the tour, certainly the oldest by a long way. And here I am, you know, fighting it out in 2-foot surf on the East Coast. And it was like you lose the stoke and you lose. And I think the organization loses the mission. So I think when Rabbit got back involved, the best surfers and the best waves is just a wonderful philosophy. And I think that the WSL is recognizing that. And they saw the power when Gabriel and Italo, when it went down to that last final at the Banzai Pipeline. I mean, that to me was like, well, that's what pro surfing is all about. And then they change it. It's like suddenly it's going to end at Trestles. I'm going like, guys, what has happened here? It's been given to you. I mean, I love the WSL and I love the dudes there. But it's like, it's been given to you on a platter. The surfers have shown and the media interest has shown what you need, the best surfers and the best waves at the most rad wave on the planet. How can you not? How can you change the winning formula that you've got? So certain things I butt heads with on the WSL, like this whole crap about losers rounds and heats. Yeah. There's no such thing as a losers round. It's like Usain Bolt, when he's running the 100 meters, he's there, and if he ain't going below 10, he's back to Jamaica on a plane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's got like 10 seconds, under 10 seconds to show his mojo. And in surfing, yeah, it's unfortunate when you travel around the world and, you know, you're in that 25-minute heat and the ocean goes flat, but you got to make it work and you got to make it happen. It's like surfing is one of the few sports where you have the lifestyle, the art form, and the competitive endeavor all focused together. And you should do it in a way that highlights the lifestyle, highlights the art, and highlights the competitive aspect. And it ain't going to happen in a 3-man losers round.
Yeah, no doubt. Let me ask you this. As I look back on the IPS, and even just like the year that the IPS formed, it was sort of loosely based off of something that Ian and some guys were doing in Australia. I believe maybe Graham Cassidy. And then you guys glommed on to the Gunston, and they glommed on to all the events in Hawaii. And in many ways, you sort of had the dream tour. I mean, you had 3 or 4 really great events, marginally great events, Bells, probably Narrabeen, you know, a couple, maybe 1 or 2 more events that were really in pretty solid waves in Australia. Then you've got great Hawaii and you've got Gunston. Like, that's kind of a mini dream tour. And then we went away from that and then we came back to it. Now it seems like we're kind of going away from it. Your thoughts on what the Australians, the groundwork that those guys laid, and then to present that to Randy and to Fred?
Yeah, I think it was very much a cooperative effort. You know, there was a tour. I mean, in 1975, I took off a year of university to go and compete in these events around the world. And even though there wasn't a world title, I mean, in fact, I remember getting a letter from Fred Hemmings at the end of 1975. You are the number one surfer in the world. And here are the RPS rankings. So, but it only started the following year. I'd won the most contests. I won the most prize money. And I'm going, well, this is pretty cool. But it was like a world championship that never really happened. And then in 1976, there was sort of this official sort of stamp of approval on the circuit. But I think Fred and Randy watched what the Aussies were doing. Ian and PT, you know, had a ranking system. So it was very much a cooperative effort. It wasn't just done by Fred and Randy. I mean, certainly there was a lot of, you know, Australian involvement. Then you had Peter Burness from South Africa, and it was very much a worldwide collaborative effort to come up with this with this tour. And yes, it's gone from maybe the best surfers and the best waves to the more the merrier, back to the best surfers and in the best waves to the more the merrier. Now we're back to, in some ways, the best surfers and the best waves with a little bit of a twist. But I think the ethos, if we can maintain that ethos of what people really want to see and who's watching, but it's the hardcore surf fanatics, we want to see the best surfers in the best waves.
Yeah.
And when I say the best waves, let me tell you, 6 foot Newcastle or 6 foot Rottnest Island to me is a great wave. I mean, I loved what happened on this Australian leg of the tour. I thought it was really, really cool. But Chopu, Banzai Pipeline, J Bay, Kira, these are the iconic waves that, you know, that surfers really want to see the best in the world going head to head at.
Let me throw this at you. The WSL and the world at large, we were all put into this precarious situation with COVID-19. And we all made and we continue to make decisions based on that. And the WSL decided to move on with the 2021 season in what is my opinion, Sean, less than stellar conditions. Some of the waves you just mentioned, Newcastle, Narrabeen, understandably, they couldn't do G-Land. They couldn't do J-Bay. But rather, they went with these sort of, in my opinion, lesser than spots, as I just mentioned. Now, what we have now is the possibility that phenomenon Jack Robinson, who I'm of the opinion the WSL needs to have these types in their CT events. Jack Robinson is in a position where he might not even qualify for the WCT in 2022. In some regards, based on decisions that were made by the WSL for 2021. What are your thoughts on Jack Robinson? And again, it hasn't happened yet, but he's 28th in the world right now.
No, I absolutely disagree with you. There's only one person responsible for Jack Robinson not qualifying, and that's Jack Robinson. Because while he's a wonderful surfer, he has got so much to learn regarding competitive mindset. It's like, you got to learn. You want to be a champion, you better learn how to be the best you can be. And Jack Robinson, it's easy to be a great surfer, but it's really hard to be a winner. It's really hard to find that competitive mindset. So I agree that we need to have these fiery surfers on the tour, but they also have got to find a way to learn how to win. Like, you know, I love to see these wild cards. You know, they got big mouths like Noah Dean, big mouth. I want to see that dude. Give him a wild card at 10-foot pop. I want to see Noah Dean with his big mouth come up against Gabriel Medina. I want to see him come up against Italo Ferreira. And let's see what happens. Let me tell you, the dude will be savaged. He'll be crying with his body will be flayed. So the guy's got a big mouth and never stops whinging about the WSL. Let's see that dude step up. You know what I mean? It's like people just let these dudes chirp, step up or shut up. That's the way I see it. And yes, I love to see these gnarly underground guys go up against the WSL. But the last time a wild card stepped up was in 1978, I think, at the Stubbies contest when Peter Harris beat Dane Kealoha. That's that's how hard it is.
How about
Parco? Don't tell me about Tom Curran.
No, Parco. Parco was a rookie, I think.
Oh, yeah, J-Bay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Parco. But that's how hard it is.
Yeah.
That's how good the crop of WSL surfers are. I mean, even the second string, well, when I say second stringers, like the guys that are not world title contenders, I mean, I look at Michel Barrez, I'm looking at like a surf god of power, and he gets his ass handed to him by the guys that are just above him. I mean, the standard of surfing, it's like mind-boggling. When I watch these events, Scott, every time I watch these events, even when I watch the event in the wave pool, like my mouth is open because I cannot believe, I cannot believe how good these guys are. And when you have these guys lobbing bombs at them from the outside, I'm going, what a damn joke. And everyone is too poop scared to say one word. Yeah. They just let these boys lob bombs. And I'm going, hey, I want to see you guy. I want to see you in a heat step up at Chopu. I want to see you step up at Cloudbreak. I want to see you step up wherever. I just want to see you step up instead of mouthing your mealy-mouthed crap.
I love it. I love it, Sean. You're bringing some hot takes here.
You can see how this. I'm going like it's so easy to like flap your lips.
Yeah. Let me ask you this: what about trimming the WCT down to 16 surfers?
I think that is. I think 32 is a good number. You know, at 32, you've got a really clean elimination. You know, 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. It's really simple. You can compress the events if you don't have all these damn losers rounds. Every single heat has incredible significance. So, you know, you can run an event in a few days. And, you know, one of the things, too, Scott, where I think there's just been like an unbelievable change in surfing is in the standard or women's surfing. It's like mind-blowing how good the women are surfing. It's really, I mean, when I watch them, it's just like some of them, it's just like raw power. And then, that you know, you have this artistic beauty like Stephanie Gilmore, and then you have Carissa Moore and I mean,
you know what we call Stephanie Gilmore is the Lady Di of surfing.
Yeah. But she's got that like gnarly power too. She's like, she's that beautiful star, but she's like a surgeon as well. You know, she just like chops it and slices it up. And, you know, I really love to watch, the women surfing and, you know, the competitive aspect that they're bringing, you know, back in our day, I mean, there were certainly some talented women surfers. I mean, Margot Oberg was just unbelievable. Like I remember surfing with her prior to a Bells event and going, man, it was like 3 to 4 foot high tide rink. And I'm going, if I got her in a heat, she'd smoke me. She was just, that's how good she was relative to the men. So they've always been great women surfers, but I think there's just a pack of really great women surfers today.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Olympic Games. I know you've got something special going on with the Olympic Games. I think Airbnb is involved. And tell me about what's going on with you and the Olympic Games. And I think there's some talks or some discussions, some live streams that you're doing.
Yeah, so I've always loved the Olympics. It was my father's dream to go and swim for South Africa in the Olympics in 1948, but he is really badly savaged by a shark before that. And Duke Kahanamoku was his hero. My dad met the Kahanamoku families after he was recuperating from his shark attack. His father flew him to San Francisco for surgery, and he ended up in Hawaii and met the whole family. So he loved Duke and his ethos, and Duke became my hero. So I've always hoped that surfing one day was going to be in the Olympics. So I'm really stoked to be doing a series. I'm doing 11 of them, these live streams. So it's just for a small group of people, like 10 to 20 people. It's really cheap. It's like $30 a head. You can look on airbnbexperiences.com, or you can just go to my LinkedIn page. So I'm doing these, it's like a 2-hour session. So I'm going to be talking about the equipment, the mindset, who the main contenders are, board design. I'm going to be speaking to, you know, I want to have a good chat with most of the shapers before, so I can get a really good indication of what the guys are riding. And then also I'm going to be doing an abridged version of my code program that I do with companies, schools, and universities all around the world, so people can get an idea of how I use surfing to empower people across the world. I use the surfing metaphor, and I'm going to talk about the surface code and how important it's been to my life and how it's impacted people around the world. So it's going to be educational, inspiring, fun, because we're going to have interactivity. And, you know, I'm hoping that people can walk away with a greater appreciation of surfing and a greater appreciation of these just unbelievable athletes who are going to be competing.
Let me ask you this. I've got a, I've got sort of a wild card to win the gold medal. And I'm wondering, who do you think is going to win gold?
Are you talking on the men's side or the women's side?
Men's side. Men's side gold medalist. Who is it?
I think, well, firstly, on the women's side, I think it's going to be very difficult to beat Carissa. I just think that, like, the men's side's a lot harder than the women's side, I think, to make a pick. On the men's side, very, very hard. And I know that your wild card is not going to be one of these two, but it's going to be very hard for Gabriel and Italo to lose. But the wild card is John.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
You're wrong. I'm going to tell you who's going to win it.
Okay, tell me.
When I tell you, I think you might see what I'm talking about here. I think the wild card, the gold medalist that steals the thunder from Kanoa Igarashi, is Japan's other surfer, Hiroto Ohara, who won the U.S. Open in Huntington Beach. He's a red-hot surfer, is totally under the radar. And when the waves are 2 feet, this kid's going to steal the thunder, and he's going to be Japan's hero.
Yeah, Hiroto, I tell you what, Kanoa, Hiroto, and Kolohi, they sort of in that, like, mix, I think, just below Italo and Gabriel and John. It's so exciting to me. It's like the first surfer to win a gold medal, and that's Duke Hanamoku status. That is like Duke Hanamoku status. So to me, this has so much significance. I mean, this is going to be, it's going to be someone who's going to lead our culture.
Yeah.
In many ways, going forward, he is going to be, you know, he's going to be on our Mount Rushmore there.
Yeah.
It's like,
let me ask you this. Here's another thought. God forbid, I don't mean to be pessimistic, but let's say the waves are 1 to 2 feet. It's wind swell. It's sloppy. It's just not very good. And there's a wave pool in Japan that the guys are actually surfing on right now to get ready for the Olympics. Should they at some point go, look, we've tried the window, the 2 weeks are up, it's crappy, let's just put this thing in the wave pool over here in Japan. What are your thoughts on that?
That Matt Biolas told me there's a typhoon coming, baby. That's what he said to me. He said.
I actually think he's right. I've been looking at the charts. There's been a lot of action. There's been a lot of There's been a lot of early action over there regarding storm systems and low pressures and such. But so no, I didn't think you didn't answer my question.
I don't think we should move to a pool. You know, I've competed in Japan many, many times, and I remember I won an event in Japan on my first modern twin fin in 1979, and it was awesome. And the surf was 1 to 2 foot, but back then I remember I could generate so much speed. These guys, even if it's 1 to 2, they're going to be going 100 miles an hour, and they're still going to be punting 3 or 4 foot up.
And I think we'll see twin fins on tour ever.
Yeah, totally. I really think that there's a place for them. And I especially think that there's a place for them at this Olympic venue.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Sean. When are you going to stop surfing? At some point, you and I, both of us, were in our, you're probably, I don't know, I'm sure you're getting
close. I'm 65.
Okay, I'm 56. I know you're as hardcore as you've ever been. I see you in the parking lot at Cardiff, suiting up when it's crappy. Have you ever asked yourself, when am I going to stop surfing?
You know, I've never asked myself that question. Scott, I'm still, you know, I'm still stoked.
And are you struggling with crowds right now?
I struggle with crowds. I mean, I don't want to get head to head, and I don't want to get aggro with some 22-year-old that's just paddled out there and oh, who's this old dude in the lineup? I'm going to paddle around him and I go, okay, we'll go for it. And then that happens again. And I go, okay, go for it. And then I go, nah. So I hate being that guy.
I do too.
Especially at my local break, you know, but sometimes, you know, you got to like, you have to speak up, but I prefer.
You're not cutting off Scott Anderson, are you?
Huh?
You're not cutting off Scott Anderson, are you?
Yeah, Scott comes out there. Scott's a gentleman in the water. You know, the little break that we surf at, we're all gentlemen out there.
I know you are. I'm just teasing you.
But it's a, but I definitely, you know, nowadays, if the surf, it's like 6 feet and low tide Rincon, I'm not going to be going there at the primo tide because I just don't want to get involved in that old hecticness. And I can go to another break and I can have as many waves, maybe not the you know, those low tide drainers, but I can still have an amazing time. And, you know, my standards on what a great wave and what a great wave I have changed. But I can get equally stoked on a wave at Campus Point where I ride like a, you know, 4 to 5 foot, like slow wave for 400 yards. It's still, I feel like I'm on top of the world. You know what I mean?
What kind of boards are you riding?
So I'm still riding a Channel Islands. I've got a model that I've had for a long time. It was called the Warp. And then I transitioned it into the Code. It was one of the first super low entry boards, you know, rocker under four.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that works well for me, especially when you get older. You know, you want that low rocker and that volume under the chest with a sort of a thicker beak nose so you can get over the edge. Still pretty modern shape, single to double concave. And it seems to, you know, work nice for me. You know, I'm always been a power surfer. I'm into power surfing. But speaking to Matt and Timmy Patterson about what the guys are riding, you know, the progressive competitive boards, they're between 4 and 4.5 pounds. How about that? Between four and 4.5 pounds.
I think that's too light. I think there's such a thing as too light of a surfboard. Your thoughts on this?
It's mind blowing. You know, I've always thought that, you know, I like a bit of weight and heft. You know, when you're coming around the corner, you want to drive it. But when you see the way that that Italo and Gabriel surf,
it's
you know, they manage to sort of still have power with that lightness. And Timmy Patterson's of this shaping theory, I mean, his theory is super simple. You know, I like to keep everything super simple and low tech. He says, I'm the most low tech shaper out there, like double four on top, single four on bottom, super basic blanks, super basic glossing construction. And he makes Italo such a basic sled that Italo can keep his mind focused on just rad maneuvers and winning. So I think a lot of with Italo's confidence just comes from simplicity and pureness.
I love that. I absolutely love that. The idea of a neutral craft that's just very simple.
That's the Greeno theory, you know? That is the Greeno theory. I read an article an interview with Greeno in Surfer Magazine in 1967 when no one had ever heard of George Greeno. And I'd heard about George Greeno from a guy called Albie Felsen, who came and stayed at my place in 1969 and told me there's this unbelievable kneeboarder called George Greeno who's revolutionized Australian surfing. He said, and all the guys are copying him, Nat Young, Bob McTavish, Ted Spencer, Wayne Lynch. And I read the article, and he talked about neutral handling. And my boards that I got from Spider Murphy and through the 70s that I used to ride deep back in the tube in and you know, really catch some different lines in the tube and a different technique was based around that theory of neutral handling. Because when you're riding back on that foam ball and, you know, you're deep inside it, 10-foot barrel on that foam ball, you want a board that's not going to have any surprises for you. Neutral handling. So it's like amazing when I speak to Timmy Patterson and he's making boards for the world champ, and it's the same type of theory in a different sort of way. It's pretty cool how things come full circle in surfing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that we, and I'm part of the problem perhaps, because I'm always getting new boards with new sorts of crap. And at the end of the day, I got a board the other day and I just want a simple tri-fin, and it's the board that I've fallen in love with. And it's just a very simple thing, you know, it's boom, it's neutral. And
Jimmy calls his number one board, he was telling me. He calls it the 84 synthetic, the 84 synthetic. He said he was working for Terry Martin.
Yeah.
He said, and Terry was making quite a lot of boards for you. And because Terry made my like boards like at a model with Herbie, with Terry Martin. But he said he had this, came up with this like 84 style, a chunky thruster, a low entry design. And he said, that's the basis for what he's shaping for Italy right now, 84 synthetic. It's a pretty cool vibe.
You know what's going to happen? As soon as this is over, I'm going to call Timmy and order a board. Oh
no! Yeah, he said it's such a cool board.
I love it. Let me ask you this. How are you staying in shape at 65? What are you riding, a 6'4"?
I'm riding I got a 6'1 and a 6'4". I got a 6'6 if it gets a bit.
How much volume is your?
I don't know the volumes. I'm not a liters guy.
What's your thickness?
But my thickness is like I'm riding 2¾ now.
Okay.
I was, you know, 2½, 2 5/8, but now I bust out. And yeah, I think I always say to people, it's not an arms race. You don't have to ride the shortest board on the beach, and you don't have to ride the thinnest board on the beach.
Yeah,
you don't want to be in a situation where you can paddle over the edge and get the wave. Otherwise, you ain't going to be having fun. So volume is your friend.
So if you could go back in time, having had the life experiences that you've had up to this point, what advice would you give the 20-year-old Sean Thompson?
In a competitive situation, attack, attack, attack. Never, ever surf defensively. And that became a bit of a problem for me in my career, that I started to surf defensively. And I think it really impacted my competitive results. So that fear of protecting your place, I would say, and I tell a lot of young athletes, if I help them, that's the focus. And that should be the simple theory, attack, attack, attack. I would rather lose a heat by trying something radical than by getting a 6'5" when you need a 6'6", or by getting an 8'7" when you need an 8'8". So it's attack, attack, attack. So I wish I had given myself that advice when I was younger.
Would you have more than one world title if you did that?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, there's a couple of times when surfing defensively caught a rail, and because it comes down to one wave often, mm-hmm. and I caught a rail. So I have no regrets, and I don't ever look over my shoulder. But looking back and looking at the, you know, advice I give to young people is what Rabbit wrote when he wrote that article, and it's sort of inspired, I think, a generation, and ultimately led Jeremy Gosch and I to making Bustin' Down the Door. It's a wonderful, a collection of simple words as a basis for success. Bust down that door.
Yeah, cool. Sean, like I said, you're one of my heroes. I love surfing with you. I get the chance once in a while. And thanks so much for being on the Boardroom Podcast. I really
thanks for doing what you do, and really, I think both inspiring people, but also inspiring the craftsmen, and paying homage to the craftsmen, because these surfboard shapers, and like I say, I've worked with 34 of them, are so honored to have worked with these amazing, amazing artists and craftsmen.
By the way. September 25th and 26th, down here in Del Mar at the Boardroom Show, we're honoring Pat Rawson this year.
Oh,
great. Yeah. So I hope that you and the wife can come down and hang out with your brother, and or whoever lives down here. I think it's your sister. And
we'll be there.
Down here. Yeah.
We'll be there. Take care. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for watching.
Cheers, Sean. Thank you.